In this episode, we are going to be reviewing Mummy Dearest from 1981, which was directed by Frank Perry, and it starred Faye Dunaway, Diana Scarwid, and my guest today, Rutanya Alda.
Welcome to Robert Bellissimo at the Movies. This is a video podcast where we explore movies from all over the world and talk about how those stories were told on film. I want to welcome back very special guest, Rutanya Alda, who is an actor, and she has appeared in over 100 films and television shows. Many of them are classics, and some of which are my favorite films. Brian De Palma's Greetings and Hi Mom, which also star Robert De Niro, Panic in Needle Park, The Long Goodbye, Scarecrow, The Deer Hunter, When a Stranger Calls, Rocky II, Amityville Part II, Law and Order, and of course, Mommy Dearest that we're discussing today. So Rutanya, welcome back. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Robert. I'm happy to see your handsome face. Thank you so much.
No, it's good to see you again, because I know we, you know, of course, we did a great interview towards the end of 2020 about your whole career. And I know, of course, you wrote in length in your book here, which, you know, if anyone hasn't read it, it's a fantastic book, The Mummy Dearest Diary, that Rutanya kept while she was filming Mommy Dearest and dealing with personal issues at the same time. And I intentionally didn't touch on it then, because I knew it was something that you've talked about so much. But I couldn't help it this time around, because I've always loved this movie. And I saw it again recently, and I just thought, I've got to talk to Rutanya about this film. So I've had just some various questions. And I just wanted to start off and ask you, because I remember in the book that you mentioned that you met Joan Crawford when you were working on Rosemary's Baby. Yes. As a stand-in and photo double. And of course, you even, your voice appears in it, did voiceover for it. What was she like when you met her then?
Absolutely charming. I suspect that she may have thought I was Mia Farrow, because it was a scene in the little theater in the village that Mia, in the script, by the way, the scene was cut. In the script, Mia and her girlfriend go to see the Fantastics. And they're in the lobby, and there is Joan Crawford and Van Johnson. And they have an exchange, like Mia's character is a fan, big fan, and they have a little short hello, nice to meet you, and this and that, and you're my favorite actress, or whatever the scenes were. But Mia was late. She was hardly late. They were stuck in traffic. I think she was coming back from Connecticut. So they were stuck in traffic. So Roman Polanski had me put on, because I did photo doubling also, the beginning of the movie up high when they're walking into the Dakota. That's really me walking with the other stand-in. Right. So Roman said, Rutanya, put on the white coat, which is what she's wearing. And I'll shoot you from the back going in. And then we'll just be ready for Mia's dialogue in the lobby. So they set it up. I went in, they photographed me going into the lobby from the back, the hair and the coat. And then they said, Roman left to consult with Bill Fraker, the cinematographer, about something. So I was just standing, and they'd filmed me going in, and I was just standing in the lobby, and Joan Crawford came over to me and introduced herself to me. Hello, I'm Joan Crawford. Nice to meet you. And I was like flabbergasted. Why would she? But she didn't realize I was the photo double, and we were waiting for, because I had the makeup the whole thing on. So I kind of stuttered And because I was really stunned, I said, "Oh, Miss Crawford, I'm so happy to meet you. I've seen so many of your movies, and I just love you, your work and everything." And she smiled. She had extended her gloved hand to me. She was in this kind of an animal print like a leopard, and with a beautiful hat and gloves. And really, it looked stunning. And so then I left. Roman said, "Come back, Ritanya." And then Mia, we exchanged coats. Mia was there. Mia put on coat. And then they went in and they did the scene. So I don't know if at that point Joan realized that I wasn't Mia, or maybe she thought I was Mia anyway. I don't know. But she was really charming. She didn't have to come over to me. Even if I was Mia Farrow, she didn't have to come over and introduce. It's the old Hollywood. They were polite. They were, they were gracious. That's the word, gracious, gracious. I mean, even when I was on John Wayne's set as a friend of somebody else, John Wayne didn't have to meet me at 6 o'clock in the morning, said hello, and brought me over to the food truck to make sure I had a good meal. I mean, who today, what star would do that? They barely show up for you.
Right,
for your close-up. So there was kind of, I think, the old Hollywood kind of embodied a kind of a graciousness. I think they were maybe trained, I don't know, to do that. The studios trained them. But she was certainly gracious to me. And even though she may have thought I was Mia, it didn't matter because she was very gracious and kind.
That's, you know, it's interesting because I was reading that Christina Crawford, she saw the film and she felt that this wasn't her mother, and she just thought she didn't like what she saw. And I'm not sure if that was more to do with Faye Dunaway's performance, because she was kind of keen on having Anne Bancroft. Do you know much about that? Like, because some of the charm, like as you said, like that she was charming, like you didn't see that in the film. Like she was just really, you know, cruel, as you saw that cruel side mostly. Do you think, I don't know if you happen to know, was that mainly Christina Crawford's problem with the film?
I'm not sure, but she just didn't like the film. She didn't think it was what she wrote. And a lot of times a writer will, of course, have that opinion. My feeling, well, not my feeling, I know Vivian Walker, the hairstylist, and Charles Schramm, the makeup artist, my makeup artist, because Faye dismissed them and brought in her own people. But they both worked about 6 or 7 movies with Joan Crawford.
Right.
And the big thing that, because I talked to them about, the big thing that they both said was, she was absolutely wonderful to the crew. She would show up, she would greet everybody by name.
Right, right.
She was charming. She gifted everybody at the end of the film with something. She remembered people's birthdays. She would call. Vivian said she never forgot my birthday. She would call me every birthday and wish me happy birthday. And they did like 6 films with her. And the crew loved her. Now, the crew did not love Faye. That's the difference. That Faye was not gracious to the crew. She kept what Charles Schramm coined the phrase, we were members of the Clear Away Club. She would insist that everybody be cleared away. I know one man got fired from the crew because he was like watching her work, watching her.
Oh, so, God.
To the Clear Away Club, even Charlie was laughing, even on the ocean, I wasn't there, and she was doing the scene, she demanded everybody be cleared away. Well, Charlie said, where are we going to go, behind the boom? That's where they're going. Behind the boom. So I think the difference between, and maybe that's what you didn't see in the film, is her, what she was known for, was
right,
her graciousness and a kindness to people she worked with. Now, what happened at home, I have no idea. Maybe that was a place to let off steam. Obviously, she was very controlling at home. Everything had to be a certain way. Everything had to be clean. I think she's known for that. And kids, of course, are not, kids, of course, you know, need to be messy. There's got to be one room where they can be messy. I mean, she had white carpets for
not a good choice. I mean, kids.
But you know, Joan, it must have been hard living like that for kids. I mean, you can only demand so much out of children. They don't,
of course,
they don't understand. So I have no doubt that they had very strict rules, and they were, and I actually, Michael, the assistant director in the, on my film, actually went to her birthday party as a kid. He said he was about eight, maybe seven, eight. And he said she was not allowed to come down to her own birthday party. She had to watch from a window because she had done something that day.
Oh, God.
Joan was really upset about, and that was her punishment.
Oh, my God. Wow.
And so it's very, I think it's disturbing in a way. Helen Hayes said that Joan should never have had kids. She really liked Joan, but she said she should never have kids. I think probably that's a certain truth, because you come from a set where everything is provided for you and you can be gracious and kind and people love you, to a home where kids are, they need other things.
Yeah.
They need joy and fun and right to be messy without being
right
controlling. And I think Joan was controlling. And as a parent, and maybe as a movie star, that works, because you control your environment in a sense. You control your space, the camera, the sound. You are in control, basically. It's set up for you, but you're in an environment that you're in control of. When you have children, you really have to lose that control.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's what's interesting in the film is that you see Joan when she was abusive towards Christina and Christopher, the son. It was always as a way to blame them. So as you just said, you know, you can't the children are not intending to make your day hell. It's just because they're, you know, they're learning, they're having fun, they're making a mess. But as you know, I don't think Joan understood that. It was always like in the film, you see, like she always thought that people were doing things to her intentionally. Like, for example, when she gets kicked out of that school, and this is when Jocelyn Brando, that scene as the reporter, and right away, you know, she tells Jocelyn Brando that, oh yeah, she was expelled, and Christina says, oh, I wasn't expelled. And then so she right away, it's like, well, you're trying to humiliate me, how dare you? And that whole fight starts. Or even, of course, earlier with the cutting her hair, and she couldn't accept that she was just playing. It's like, no, you must be making fun of me, you must be doing this. So I don't know, you know, obviously back then they didn't know much about mental health. I mean, who knows what she had? She obviously had something. But I thought that they showed that abusive personality quite well, in terms of it's blaming people for the littlest, tiniest of things that would just set her off. I don't know how you felt. Did you feel that was effective in the film?
I think it was effective in the film. I think that was Joan's issue. That's why Helen Hayes said she should never have children.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Because otherwise people liked her. She was very, you know, affable and charming and lovely and gracious. But kids don't understand that kind of control. Or those
exactly.
Even the eating scene where she kept putting the steak.
Oh, right. Right.
I believe those stories are true. I think that she had to control her. So she would eat that meat because it was good for her.
Right.
But listen, my son didn't eat a lot of stuff. I said, well, later on you'll like sushi.
So you played Carol Ann, of course, this woman who's, you know, who I know that the Carol Ann was based on a number of different people who worked for Joan. over the years. And of course you had to, you know, admire her and love her. And I thought you did that quite beautifully. And I was curious, as an actor, when you're working with another actor, you who's, as you said, Faye was so toxic on the set, how did you find a way to be genuinely sort of affectionate with her in those scenes? Because I know myself as an actor, when I've had to do that and I don't perhaps care for the other person, you really got to go into your toolkit, you know? So I was curious how you found that.
Well, I knew that no matter what Faye did, I had to justify, oh, look how she's so great about yelling at people. Oh, look, she wants privacy. That's why we're the Clear White Club. Oh, look how lovely she looks. Look at her beautiful wardrobe. I had to make everything about her positive. That's why it was a little bit schizophrenic. That's why I journaled. That's why I journaled, because in real life, it was very difficult, really difficult.
Oh, for sure.
As Carol Ann, I had to love everything she does. I had to justify even the kids. I had to justify, well, they need to love her. They need to respect her. I mean, this is not a way to treat kids. But at that time, I had to justify saying, well, they should really respect her.
Right.
Well, they should really do what she says. Oh, they should really, you know. So I had to justify, like even when she slapped me hard, I had to say, well, she has to slap me because she needs to be really good for this audition. So but personally, as Ritanya, I thought, oh my God, that really fucking hurt. You know, it's like, but then I had to switch it around to the actress thing, where you justify everything that they do so that you're always in their corner, as Carol Ann is to Joan. Like Betty, I got a chance to talk to Betty Barker, who was the longest one of the four employees. She worked for Joan, I think, 25 years. So she was the longest one. And it was interesting because she really didn't want to reveal too much about her, but she just thought Joan was wonderful. She never had an unpleasant day with Joan. Joan was this, Joan was that. And I thought, well, Betty Barker is sort of Carol Ann.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Because she did not have one bad thing to say about Joan, and she didn't want to reveal too much. She was very tight-lipped. But she did, the way she talked about her, it was like everything was wonderful and Joan was wonderful and everything was terrific. So that's sort of how I had to approach Carol Ann. No matter what happens, she's wonderful. And of course, I wanted to do the lesbian aspect of it, but she's really in love with Joan. But Like I wanted at one point, I said, Frank, I just want to pick up her, maybe her nightgown or a pair of her stockings and just kind of feel them, you know, the softness and the beauty of silk or whatever. Frank thought about it for 10 seconds. He says, no, we can't go there. We just can't go there. So I thought,
that's a good idea.
If we had gone there a little bit, that could have been. She was she was in love silently. Nothing ever happened, obviously, like
right
with Carol Ann's character or even Betty Barker's character. I don't know for sure. I'm guessing.
Right.
It's very professional. Betty Barker would answer all her fan mail. I mean, she was in sort of like Carol Ann was. And Joan Crawford was her life. She had no other life except Joan.
Right.
I'm kind of sorry that they cut the opening scene where I meet Joan, which is
I was going to ask you about that.
Which was she went because Faye as Joan recognizes me and says, "Oh, Carol Ann, you're here again." Because obviously I wait for her. I must have 40 or 50 autographs. I said, "Oh yes, Miss Crawford, I'm always be here for you," and then she looks, she says, Caroline, get in. I have a job. Would you miss a job for me with me? And I said, oh, yes, yes, yes. And she says, she opens the door. She says, get in. Now, I'm really sorry that scene was cut, because that kind of establishes the fact that she's there every day after work when the limousine comes out with her autograph book. And she's been there so often that Joe recognizes her and sees the devotion to her. And that's why she wants to employ her, because she sees that Carol Ann will always be devoted. Now, when they cut that scene, of course, they had to cut a lot. There's a lot cut. And they went over schedule. And some things weren't shot because Frankie Blonds, the producer, pulled the plug. They were so over budget. It would be probably like $1 million today, but it was probably $250,000 or more. And he just finally said, whatever you've got, I'm pulling the plug on this day.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that would have established that relationship much better. And I think, you know, because I was reading, apparently, and I'm sure you know this, like Joan Crawford, when she was young, you know, her mother abandoned her, her father or stepfather was very abusive towards her. So I wonder if they could have had some, you know, I don't think they would have had to have spelled, you know, I actually hate when movies spell out every single motivation, but even some kind of suggestion as to why she was the way she was, because it was maybe the audience could have sympathized a little more with her. I don't know. Was there anything showing that got cut that you recall? Or
not about her early life. I read the two books on her, and she had a very, very hard life.
Yes. Yeah.
And one of the schools she went to, private school, she got her scholarship, but in return for that, she had to clean the toilets and rooms and halls.
Yes.
And she's like 15. And of course, you know, all those rich girls looked down at her and made fun of her and all that. And she really grew up in poverty.
Yes.
And I think that's why she left at 16, I think, really young, to become like a chorus girl. And the talk is she made some blue movies and to get by, and then the chorus, she joined the chorus line, and then eventually soon after that she went to Hollywood. I think she was like 18 or 19.
Right.
She's, and that's one of the reasons I think in the, when she's, you see all those beautiful dresses that she's bought for Christina, and how she goes crazy that she doesn't hang them up, because for Joan, somehow they could have put that in the script. Joan didn't have those beautiful dresses. She was poor. She had one or two dresses and when she came to Hollywood, well, I think luckily she got in and was able to make a living, background or whatever she was doing, until she you know, got roles. But those dresses in her childhood were, I mean, I identify with that, because growing up in refugee camps, I had one dress, which my grandmother would keep washing. And then I got one more dress. So for me personally, when I made some money, I spent it all on dresses and clothes, because I didn't have that.
Right.
Until I realized that I was really throwing away a lot of this money and it didn't mean that much. But it took me several years to come to terms with the fact that I was made fun of at school because I wore the same dress when I came to America. I wore the same dress for a week and the girls would make fun of me. Now, I'm sure this is true with Joan when she was in that school. I'm sure that girls can be very cruel. At that age, girls are meaner than boys. They're very catty and nasty. Sorry, girls, but if you admit it, it's true.
For the record, I didn't say that.
I know I had a terrible time. But I had one pair of shoes and one and two dresses. And at school in America, I was like really made fun of, and really by the girls. The boys could care less. And so when I got my job working full time at 12 to 19, 20, when I came to America, when I came to New York, I spent so much of my money on clothes when I got work that I really would have really been better if I'd saved some of it. But because it was like that, so I understand where Joan was coming from.
Yeah.
When you throw these beautiful clothes on the floor, it doesn't have the same meaning to you. If you have 25 beautiful dresses and you can throw one on the floor, why not? That's how kids think. It wasn't explained, I'm sure, to Christina that, look, this is a luxury because this is not how I grew up. Right. Maybe in a scene like that would have been helpful to have that written in because, you know, I think these young things, especially teenage years, that really affect you if you've been abused by other young people, your peers, bullied in a sense about clothes and how you look. It can be very damaging. And I think, well, besides that era, Joan Crawford, when she went out in public, always looked meticulous and looked. And I think that's not just because they groomed you at that time to always look good when you're out in public. But besides that, I think underneath it all, she needed to look good.
Yes.
There was a need to be perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Which that also kind of that makes sense why, like, having all those dresses on a wire hanger would have set her off in such a way. But I suppose because it's from Christina's point of view, you don't see the whys behind why Joan was doing everything, because Christina doesn't, wouldn't have known. I was curious what Jocelyn Brando was like. Cause I, you know, when I watched it again, you could really see how much she looked like Marlon. I mean, they had a strong resemblance. What was she like?
Just lovely. We had a lot of wait time, so we just talked.
Yeah.
She had been in a very bad accident, really horrible accident. I was in the hospital for like 2, 3, 4 months. And she told the story of, I think I put it in my book, she had her very good friend who was a hairdresser. She didn't want to cut her hair. She had long hair. She put it up in a bun. And she didn't want, and her friend came for months and just by hand took all the knots out of her hair. And she was telling me that story of how much that meant to her, because then she still had her hair she could put into a bun. And then she said about Marlon, she didn't talk too much about him. She said that he was very close to his mother, very, very close to his mother. And even though she was an alcoholic, the mother was an alcoholic, that he was very tied to her mother, to the mother. And I don't know what that means psychologically, but I'm sure that was something was with him. And then knowing that his alcoholic mother was often abusive.
Right.
But she said he was really, that was his mother, was he loved her so much.
Mm.
So you don't know, you know, you'd have to be a more competent person than me to connect maybe how he could never commit to women. He had
a lot of
women, but those relationships never worked. And so I'm sure all of this, you know, when we look back, a lot of these things connect into our adult life.
Oh, and, absolutely.
Yeah, and we kind of, you know, have those repercussions.
Other than that,
I don't remember. I might have put something in my book, but I don't remember. And he said she was he was always talented. He always loved, and the mother loved theater.
Yes,
the mother loved theater and movies. And that they shared that together. So she's always taking him to the theater or the movies. I don't remember anything about the father. So father was apparently not a very strong.
Yeah, he was an abusive guy.
Yeah. So there you have it. Father's abusive, he loves his mother, but she's alcoholic and she has those moments of abuse also. So but I thought Jocelyn was just, and she does look like Marlon, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. She was a strong. There was a side profile of her in the film at a certain point, and I thought, oh my god, I mean, they look so much alike. Even when you see her when she was younger, like a film that she's in that I love is the Big Heat with Glenn Ford.
Oh, yeah.
And wow, I mean, the striking resemblance. So I was curious what she was like. It's interesting, this film. I always am perplexed as to why it has this camp reputation, because I know that Paramount marketed it that way because people were sort of, you know, going to the movies with wire hangers and laughing and stuff, so they capitalized on it. But I personally don't find it as very over the top or campy. I don't know how you feel when you see it now.
Well, I haven't. I've done a couple of Head of Lettuce events down at the downtown theater, but not for the last 3 or 4 years. And Head of Lettuce is a brilliant comedian, and she would do asides to the film. And people were roaring with laughter. I think somehow it's in the lines, and it's in the over the top performance of Faye. And also, I think it just, it took off in a whole way that, believe me, they did not expect.
Right, no, I know. I know that Frank, the producer, Yamblins, I believe.
Yablons,
sorry. That he sued Paramount over the way they marketed it. Just he was appalled that they made it into like a campy comedy, and he was like, "No, this is a drama. This is a story of abuse." And it's really interesting how it's turned this way, because I don't even find Faye Dunaway particularly over the top. A couple of times, yes, like the wire hanger scene and the tree cutting scene, a little bit. But then again, I think, well, look at the situations. I mean, she gets out of her contract by Louis B. Mayer, and she's cutting trees down. And these are extreme reactions. So I sometimes wonder if maybe people are blurring the performance with the situations and thinking that it's Faye who's the one who's being too large. Because I actually think that she's really good. I know that she perhaps didn't have as much of the charm that you experienced when you met Joan, and other people have said, including Christina, that she always looked really kind of like angry in the film, you know? So perhaps, you know, someone like Anne Bancroft could have brought that in, but I don't find her too over the top. I don't know what you think in general. I know it's hard because she was not the best to work with, but objectively, I was curious what you thought.
I think she's wonderful in the movie.
Yeah, me too.
She's really wonderful. She chose that. Believe me, it was her choice, not tries to blame it on Frank Perry. But she came in with that choice and she went with it. And it was powerful, very powerful, her work. My sad thing is that she doesn't own it. She should say, look, I'm fucking great in this movie.
Yeah.
She should own it and say, you know, that's and just say, this is like nothing I ever did before. And it was in my body work. This is unique. And I love myself in this movie. Now, I know she did like herself in this movie before she denied it.
Right.
As I went to she did a play about a year after the movie on Broadway. I forgot the name of it now, but I went to see it. And I was one of the few people that was allowed in the dressing room afterwards, after the play. And she said, oh, I'm going to get an Oscar nomination for this, but I'm not going to win because this is too controversial. So I think she, just by what she said, she was expecting a nomination because she thought her work was really good. And I think her work was really good.
I agree. I think it's an incredible performance. I think it's amazing.
It's like every bit as Shakespearean.
Absolutely.
As the big Shakespearean plays. Almost like a Medea. Almost like, it's like, and she committed herself to that and she did it. And I think she's fabulous.
The film at times, and I think it's just kind of organically happened, but I found myself chuckling a couple of times because there's a sense of irony every now and then, particularly when they're rehearsing, when you're rehearsing for her screen test for Mildred Pierce, and she slaps you, and then the line is something along the lines of, oh, you don't know how much it kills me to hit you, and then they cut to Christina, the little girl, looking at her like, yeah, right. Like, I could, that there's something funny in a dark way about that, or even the steak scene that you mentioned, like, I mean, that's not funny, that what she did to her daughter, you know, made her sit there all night and then gave it to her the next day at breakfast and made her bring it to her room. But then when she finally gives up and then Joan says, why must everything be a contest? I couldn't help but laugh, you know.
There's some great lines in this.
Absolutely.
And they are. It's like every... I really love that line. Why does everything have to be a contest? Because that's what it is with kids.
Exactly. Sometimes.
And you got to choose your battles.
Exactly.
Eventually, just not worth that battle for that. But I think there's some very funny lines. But I think that's one of the reasons why this film, well, it's become great with the gay community. They really embrace it. They embrace it now. So it's become a cult film. It has legs. Like, what other movies have these kind of legs and the following, and people still follow it. People see it over and over again at once a year or whatever. So, I mean, there's something about this film that really attracts people. They want to see it again.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very, I don't know what it is. It's so captivating. It's just a combination of the characters, the performance, the story, and even the production design. That house, I mean, everything is so grand and, larger than life. And even her rituals in the morning when she wakes up dunking her face into ice. And I don't know, there's just something. As soon as it starts, I'm totally... it just draws you right in. So I'm not surprised people just, you know, yearly watch this film because it's strong. I find it's very powerful.
Bringing up the her rituals that she does every morning, she's very disciplined, and Joan Crawford was very disciplined.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if that kind of, she expected that discipline for herself, and then she expected that discipline for little kids.
Probably.
You're too young.
Yeah.
You're just too young. You don't understand it. You don't understand it and why. So I wonder if that carried over in how she treated the kids. Also, I think when she was at work, she had to be this gracious, wonderful person, because you don't want to get a bad rap with people that you work with, especially in that era.
Right.
So I wonder if the stress of just having to always be perfect, that you release it and the ones you love at home, that you take it out on people at home because you can't take it out at work or in public.
Yeah.
And it's a safe space to take it out at home. I know people in relationships will come in and yell at their wife or their husband because they had a nasty day. They kind of vent at them, because they, in the end, they can apologize and all of that stuff, and hopefully that person will accept it if it's not too much all the time.
Right, because there's consequences when you do it at work, right? Like you could lose your job, or like you see when she's with Louis B. Mayer in the film, even though Louis B. Mayer is, you know, when he insists on her having dinner with her at the restaurant, like you see that she's not happy, but she doesn't get mad. She doesn't say anything. Even when he lets her out of the contract, at first he's praising her. Oh, there's no one like you. And then the next sentence, well, you're getting a little older. Sorry. Yeah. You know, your box office poison. And it's like, oh, but she never gets mad. You know, she never gets mad at anyone other than the people at home, as you said.
Yeah. Because, and especially during the time when she lets go, she thinks her career is over with when she lets go, and she's let go at MGM. And it must have been just fantastic pressure on her, because her career, of course, later Warner Brothers, Mildred Pierce was and saved her.
Yeah.
But for those months or a year or whatever it was, the thought of her career that she'd worked so hard for was over, must have been the most intensive time in her life.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And who was there to take it out on?
Right.
Kids.
Right. I do think, on the other hand, as much as people talk about, you know, the wire hanger scene and the cutting of the hair and all the, like, the abusive scenes, I did find they did strike an interesting balance at times, where you did see the love between Joan and Christina. And I know that Christina Crawford did say that they, towards, you know, later in her life, they tried to rebuild their relationship, and she forgave her. And then, you know, but then, of course, when she died, what you see in the film is that she was disinherited, which Christina just couldn't understand why she did that. But there were some scenes, particularly when she has those money issues and in the basement when they're doing laundry, and she's very vulnerable and crying about how worried she was about money. And Christina says, you know, no, we'll get by, we'll be okay. Or, of course, even at the end when she accepts the award on her behalf, and Joan is watching from her bedroom. She was in a hospital. She's very moved and crying. And then even that scene where she visits her at her apartment and she gives her a gift. I forgot about, it's been a while since I've seen it, and I forgot that there were some warm scenes. I don't know if did you found that they struck a good enough balance to show some of the sort of better sides in their relationship, or what did you think?
You know, I think they're all constrained with time, in terms of, you don't want a movie that's 3 hours long.
Right, right.
This movie could easily have been 2.5 hours long. There was a lot of stuff left out.
Yeah.
I think that on the long run, I think that has an influence on what they took out, in terms of making it more whole. In terms of, I think they had to just add, I think it's, I don't know how long it is. It's an hour and a half.
It's just over 2 hours.
Oh, it is over 2 hours.
Yeah.
Well, it could have been 3 hours easily, because they cut a lot out. And I think a lot of it was just in the cutting, was just they had to do away with certain scenes that maybe would have made things more understandable.
Yeah.
But they got a lot in. I didn't know it was 2 hours. But they're telling a very complex story.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that was beloved by a huge fan base. So, and then you don't want to believe that your favorite star, or one of your favorite stars, can be abusive. You don't, even in today's world.
Yes, yeah.
We glamorize those people and into that they're perfect. And they're not. They have a lot of challenges about their own life and their own. I just read a thing about this actor that was nominated for one of the SAG Awards. And I really love him as an actor. I won't mention his name. But the fact that he abandoned his wife, who was pregnant, had another relationship with another actress, and now is on a third relationship with a third actress. That's now in several years. So I'm thinking, well, as much as I admire him as an actor, I don't necessarily want it to go beyond that because I don't admire what he did to these women.
Right, right.
But it's not something that's admirable, but it's his life. I'm not going to go and say, I'll never see another performance of this. I will see another performance, but don't make them, don't glorify them.
Yeah.
Don't glorify them into people. They have the same challenges we don't hear about. This is about rock stars and rap stars and movie stars and television stars. There can be wonderful actors, wonderful artists, but their lives are sometimes more messed up than our lives are.
I just wanted to lastly ask you, I was curious because I like Frank Perry's films a lot. The Swimmer and Diary of a Mad Housewife. And I think he's a wonderful director. What was he like? How did he work with actors? Did he give you a lot of freedom or was he specific with what he wanted or what was he like?
Also David and Lisa. That was his first claim to fame. Broke his, kind of opened the doors for him.
Yes.
Frank was a wonderful person to work with. He gave you a lot of freedom. If he felt like you were going off, then he would sit with you and guide you. But he always thought that your first take or two were the best ones. He didn't want to over rehearse people because he said, I believe you're going to get it in the first or second take. Otherwise, we have to work on it. But he believed that the truth was in the first and second take. Also, he's one of the few directors that I didn't have to audition for. I went to his apartment on Park Avenue. I mean, he had everybody scheduled like 30 minutes apart. So you didn't see the other act when you left the other actor, where you didn't see who was coming in for your part. But when I met him, I just talked to him. We had a conversation about a lot of things. And I didn't have to read for him. He didn't read anyone. He went with his gut instinct. That's rare.
Yeah, that's like unheard of nowadays.
Unheard of nowadays. They make you audition to the gazoo. And
absolutely, yeah.
He trusted the actor. When he hired you, he trusted you. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't have to audition for him either. He just said, I just trust you. So actually, all of my takes were one or two takes. Because he felt he got it. If he got it on the first take, he said, I've got it. Because sometimes I would ask Frank, well, what if he said, no, I've got it. Trust me, I've got it. If I didn't have it, I would.
He would tell you.
And that's how he worked. He felt like you were more truthful in the first take or two.
Right.
I don't think I ever had more than two takes with him.
Wow.
On what I did. And he loved actors. He really did. He just loved actors. He loved the whole process. So
that's good to hear. Yeah, no, because he's a wonderful filmmaker. I hope more and more filmmakers or screenwriters or DOPs or even actors look back. I mean, a lot of his films are really underrated. Play As It Lays and David and Lisa. I'm just looking at his filmography. He was really great. But so that's good to hear that he was good to work with as well. I know you talk about him in the book. And again, the book is called The Mummy Dearest Diary, which is not just about Rutanya's diary when she worked on the film, but also about her early life in Latvia and working with so many great filmmakers and her early life in career in New York. And it's a really, really great, great book. Where's the best place for people to find this? Is it pretty much available anywhere where you can get books are sold pretty much?
Amazon.com for sure. I think maybe Barnes & Noble has it on their website to order, but for sure Amazon. This is probably the best price.
Okay, great. And can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on now, the film you're working on now?
Well, the film I'm working on now is called USA, The Land of the Mustaches. And it's about my early life as a child. It's told from a child's point of view of growing up in refugee camps post-World War II. And it ends with coming to America. But people may not realize that after World War II, there were 12 million refugees. The Allies were not prepared for that number. So the conditions growing up were very difficult. We lived in bombed out buildings. Food was very scarce. There was a lot of hunger. But through the child's eyes, you see a scope of what they see. It's told. So some things are funny and some things are just told, like when the person lies down on the tracks and commits suicide, woman who's haunted my dreams for years, that I share this story also with Joe Esterhaus, who I saw on television talking about seeing this woman lying down on the tracks, committing suicide because she didn't want to be sent back to Stalin's gulags. Now, people don't know what gulags are, but gulags were forced labor camps.
And right.
Torn off the streets and stuffed into a cattle car and sent to one of Stalin's gulags, which one of the gulags he shared with Solzhenitsyn when they were digging coal together. So all of this is in my film. And also the thing about sharing that story with Joe Esterhaus, how we both saw it in different ways, and how he dealt with it, but a lot of it is a story that the reason my team, my director, my editor, my animator, all came aboard is because they've never heard this story before and they love the story. So they're all working pro bono. I mean, imagine all these people with academy credits and they're all working pro bono. So I'm getting them to work when they're not working. So they're doing this in between their spare time. So that's why it's probably won't be out till 2023. We'll send it to film festivals, hopefully get picked up. But it's been a really remarkable journey because I've had to learn not only be the storyteller of this story, but and it was over 2 hours long. David has cut it down to 1 minute, 1:30, which is what we want to keep it at 1:30. So that's why I'm aware of now editing that you have. That's why I mentioned your Mommy Dearest, that they had to cut maybe some of the things that would have made more sense. They had to cut it down. So we're cutting it down at 1:30. And I'm really grateful and excited because honestly, I always felt, I did it in the middle of the lockdown in New York with these four wonderful people on my team that came to help me, is because I said, if I don't tell the story, this story will never get told. And that's why I encourage other people, especially because I'm going to be 80 in October. I really felt vulnerable, more vulnerable to coronavirus. I wasn't scared, but I said, you know, life has a limit. It all comes to an end somewhere, sometimes unexpectedly, like a woman lying down the tracks, or in my story, when a man blows his brains out in the kitchen and my grandmother has to clean it up when I see a piece of his brain.
Oh, God.
Then I think this is the whole universe. I'm holding the universe in my hand, whole person's brain, a little piece of it in my hand. You know, we don't know what the next day is. You know, it's like my late husband was walking on the green light and the bus made the turn so wrong he was crushed under the wheels.
Right.
He was on his way to have coffee. I mean, you don't know. It's very ephemeral. It's very, we just have to say, let's tell our stories because if we have a story, tell it because you don't know when your time is up. You don't know. You could live to 100. I could live to 90.
Yeah.
Nothing is guaranteed.
I appreciate that you took the time again to talk to me today about Mommy Dearest and best of luck with the film. I'm really looking forward to seeing it and hearing more about it. And again, everyone, check out this great book. It's a great read. I really, really enjoyed. So, Rotanya, thanks again for coming on, and I hope you could come again sometime.
Oh, anytime, honey, anytime.
Thank you so much, everyone, for watching. I want to thank all of my members on Patreon. If you're interested in becoming a member of my Patreon, head over to the link patreon.com/RobertBellissimo at the movies for full details. Patreon is bonus content that I create month in and month out. And it is based on polls that I send out at the beginning of every single month in which you can vote on, which means you'll very much be a part of the decision-making as to what I record on Patreon month in and month out. So head over to the link for full details. If you are currently listening to this on the audio version of the podcast and you've run out of episodes to listen to, head over to the YouTube channel where every single episode that I have ever recorded can be found, youtube.com/RobertBellissimo at the movies. And lastly, if this is your first time here, please consider subscribing to my channel by pressing the Robert Bellissimo at the movies logo. You will see it floating above my head in the top left corner to your top left. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release one of my new videos or when I go live. Thank you so much, everyone. I will see you in the next episode.